This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This season at the First Time Podcast, we are returning to our first time roots. We hear all the time from listeners who've gone from thinking about writing a book to starting to write a book to having their very own debut author experience.
One of the things that these new authors say is that they've gone back and listened to all the episodes that cover off the various milestones. So this year we're going back too. We want to capture that first time again ourselves. We're going to follow a first-time author across the year, catching up multiple times along the way.
Our very first follow a first-timer is Megan Rogers, author of The Heart is a Star. This segment of Follow a First-Timer is brought to you by HarperCollins. Megan Rogers began her working life as an editorial assistant at Allen & Unwin before moving to the State Library of Victoria in marketing. In 2014, Megan finished a PhD in creative writing at RMIT, which resulted in the book Finding the Plot, A Maternal Approach to Madness in Literature, published by feminist publisher Demeter Press. She also has a Bachelor of Arts Science, a Diploma of Professional Writing and Editing, a Graduate Diploma in Professional Communication, and a Master's of Marketing. Megan lives on the Mornington Peninsula outside of Melbourne. Megan, the last two episodes with you, we've heard about your early writing life, including the infamous Herb book, where the idea for The Heart is a Star came from, writing process, and how the book came to be published. This episode, we're going to pick up where we left off. So to cast your mind back, you had just accepted an offer for publication from HarperCollins. The editing process is about to begin or begins. What did it look like?
Oh, I think one of my greatest desires was to have someone that I respect of a high caliber read my work deeply. And I think as a writer, you know, that's one of the dreams, isn't it? To have someone spend the time reading your whole novel and seeing you. You know, I think that even if your book isn't biographical, to have someone read your work, it just makes you feel seen. And I had, and I still do, have a massive girl crush on Catherine Milne. And I love her deeply on all levels. And I had seen what she had done with other books.
So you were familiar with her work?
Oh, yeah, previously. I came in to tell you something. It's a bit embarrassing. But so in lockdown, this is a bit of a tangent, but I'll come back to your question. The girls and I, you know, we were in the Melbourne lockdown and the only thing kind of open that we could get to was a news agent. So I decided it's a bit woo-woo, but we'd make some vision boards as you do when you've been locked up, you know. And so I spent like a small silly fortune on magazines and cardboard. And we sat at the dinner table and we spent a few hours because, you know, at that stage, you're just searching for anything you can do besides make sourdough bread and Play-Doh. So we were making vision boards and I was just about to send it out to publishers. And I made a vision board and I put on that vision board HarperCollins and Catherine Milne because she has a blog on the HarperCollins website and there's this picture of her with her bookshelves behind her. And I had read some of the things that she'd said about writing, and she just seemed so passionate and one of those really rare finds that is big head, big heart.
Oh, I love
the capacity to understand words on the page, but also the capacity to understand a writer and all of their insecurities. And I thought if I could have that in my life, then I would have made it, you know.
So you manifested.
So, yeah. So I actually sent her an image of that vision board too after we signed, which she just squealed at, which was very sweet. So, you know, that was the dream. And it didn't mean that I didn't consider other publishers, of course, because they were so amazing. And, you know, I always try to stress that too because, you know, they really were. And you know, no decisions had been made or anything. But, yeah, I had. And so to have her coming back to the question about editing, having her do a structural edit of my book was one of the most deeply moving experiences I think, of my life. You know, she sent me, I think it was, you know, pages and pages of not just things that she felt could be, you know, that she wanted to know more about or things like that, but also too just her almost analysis of the text. And I still look at that document, I cry, because to feel, and I think, you know, many people, and me, but like, you know, you grow up wanting to have a romantic relationship with whoever that is and be seen. For me, it was the same kind of thing to be seen by someone I respected so much in my work. And so her structure letter was the first step really after I signed.
And did parts of that analysis surprise you?
You know, it's funny. It's like, you know, when people say something to you and it's so obvious. It surprised me more that I hadn't seen it before. That's what surprised me, I think. You know, it was everything she was saying was so true and so helpful. And, you know, there are many moments where I read it and felt embarrassed that I hadn't seen something, because you come, you know, become so close to the work, as you know, and I felt embarrassed. I did. I you know, I thought, oh, how did I not see that? Or how did I not pick up on that? Or how did I not fix that before I even sent it to her? You know, we don't do these things. And so to go through and then it was thrilling to respond to her feedback with craft and with thought and with respect, and then to send her that draft back. Mind you, I felt nauseous. Felt nauseous until I got an email back from her, because I'm a bit of an overthinker. So, you know, in my mind, you know, if she's not getting back to me quickly, I'm like, she hates it. I've just completely ruined everything. And, you know, I didn't take on her feedback properly. So, which of course didn't happen. So that was the next step for me, was her structural edit, taking in her advice, making those changes and sending it back.
We do gravitate to the worst case scenario, don't we?
Catastrophizing.
Yes. Frustrating. I'm interested in the nuts and bolts of how you approach that feedback. So you had a multi-page document. Yep. Are you naturally a pantser or a plotter? What did you do from, you know, taking the words and the things that she had written down, how did you enact them and play
That's
with
a
them?
Great script? I am equally a plotter and a pantser. I'm a bit both. Like, I'm a bit art science. I'm always been a bit both. So I plot when I write, because I think I'm time poor, you know, I'm a working mum. And so I need to know that when I sit down to write, it's going towards something, even if I don't necessarily use it exactly. So I plot the novel. And then as I'm writing it, things will be uncovered and I'll discover things and it'll slightly change. But I need some scaffolding to write into. So the feedback that Catherine gave me was within that scaffolding. So the scaffolding was still there. That never changed. There was a filling out of a couple of the chapters towards the end, which I think is probably not uncommon. You know, I think some of the characters that their roundedness and their backstory was in my head. And I think sometimes, I don't know if other writers feel this too, but I'll write and then the grey blurriness between what's on the page and is what's in my head is not always clear. So I had to kind of get some of that stuff that was in my head on the page rather than just assuming that people knew about it. So to answer your question, I was able to, I guess, use the structure I already had and enjoy the panster element, I guess, of, you know, just thinking, you know, well, within that scaffolding and within that structure, even though it's a structural edit, you know, there's still big picture things. And, you know, how will I bring that character's, you know, perception that is in my head a bit more to life, you know, on the page.
So you did the structural edit with Catherine. Did she do the copy edit and the proof with you? No. How did that work?
No. So I have an in-house managing editor, Belinda, she's the stuff of dreams. You know how, like, when you're, I was a girl growing up, I was, you know, the avid reader who dreamed of having an editor who wore tweed and all yeah, that kind of stuff.
I know. Slash agent, like a bit of
both. Slash agent, totally right. Yeah. I'm not embarrassed to say it. And Linda is everything and more. She's old school in the most beautiful way, and she's talented and old school and lovely. And so she managed the process once the structural edit had been done. So she engaged a copy editor, and I was really, really lucky with the copy editor who used to hold a similar position to Catherine, but is retired, Joe. And she gave me a spectacular copy edit. And again, just I have been blessed at every single stage with having the most astounding, talented people, I guess, my corner. And I'm not, I'm very well aware that I should be grateful for that. And so my copy edit, again, like, you know, it's that kind of upside down pyramid, you know, that's, I'm not telling anyone anything they don't know, so I'm sorry about that. But, you know, Catherine gave me that big picture stuff. And then Joe, you know, she filled in the middle ground, which was, you know, more about dialogue, more about setting, more about line by line items. That's when I started to get embarrassed about my repeated phrases, repeated hand gestures.
Do you have like a signature phrase that had to be ironed out of the book?
So it's so funny, isn't it? Because like I get even embarrassed now, even just thinking about how idiotic. I mean, it's embarrassing, right? But you've got so much to think about. You've got to cut yourself some slack, right? Mine were all about mostly physical gestures. So, you know, and I try not to have it too much in dialogue, but I like to kind of create a visual world as much as I can. And so, you know, I would have people's hands slapping down on their thighs, or, you know, a man stroking the side of his face. Or so what I ended up doing is I ended up going out and sitting and watching. I tell you what, my neighbor would probably think that I'm some kind of stalker, because I spent a few weeks just sitting around the neighborhood, just like watching people and then taking notes.
It is really hard to have those gestures and those things that are in some ways an anchor point for dialogue, which is where you get like the sighing and the shrugging and the
sighing. Oh yeah. I love a good sigh, apparently. And I think too, the difficulty is that you're also trying to create a character that has mannerisms and tics and repeated gestures, because people do repeat the gestures, but on the page, it can't be like that, even if somebody would. So I spent a lot of time stalking people in my neighborhood and writing down, you know, when they were half smiling, or when they flipped their hair over, or when they closed one eye and tilted their head, and all that kind of stuff. So I spent a long time just like opening up my horizons in terms of and like my physical gestures in other ways were okay. It was more just those little ones that yeah, you're right, anchor the dialogue, or you know, often like I was trying to, you know, that, and it's one of my most I won't use the word hate, but I don't like the phrase show don't tell, because I'm a big believer in showing and telling. Like, it's a show and tell, you can do both. And I think for many years I was so paralyzed by that saying that we were brought up with in writing classes, you know, show don't tell, don't tell anything. I was paralyzed, and I think it's still really valid, but in those gestures I was trying to show something, show a reaction, show a feeling without telling it per se. And so I just needed to get a little bit, I think, open it up a bit more, so that everyone was sighing all the time or like slapping their knees, or yeah
that must be the most oft quoted advice, the show don't tell, isn't it?
Yeah,
but can perhaps go too far in one direction.
Oh, that's right. I mean no advice is bad advice necessarily, but I just think if it does paralyze you, it's not necessarily helpful. And sometimes we do need to know the inner world of a character, and we do want to know, kind of, we want them to tell us how they're really feeling, like a, you know, like a friend would, or like we tell ourselves, you know. But I think at the end of the day, it depends on genre and style as well, of course, and I think that there's a time and a place for both.
How much do you think the book changed through the editing process?
Oh, that's a really good question. So let me think about this. You know what it was like and I haven't actually thought about this before, but so it's like, you know, when they do that experiment about a full jar, and they have a jar and they've got ping pong balls in it, and they go, does this jar look full to you? And it's got ping pong balls in it. And you go, yeah, that jar's full. And then they pour little pebbles into it. And of course, there's heaps of room. There's a whole container filled full of it now. And they say, oh, does it now look full to you? And you're like, yeah, yeah, it's definitely full now. And then they pour sand in. And then you think, oh, come on, it's definitely full now. And then they pour water in. And they've been able to fill up to varying greater degrees this jar. And I feel as though that was the process of book editing for me, where I had probably gotten to the stage where I had the ping pong balls and the pebbles. And I think it didn't change. So they were always there. That didn't change. But what changed was just, you know, pouring in some sand and pouring in some water, and really, you know, something that I thought was, you know, I knew it wasn't complete per se, but I didn't necessarily know how to fill it up more. And I think Catherine and Joe and my proofreader, because of course then it went through proofreading as well, you know, they just helped me fill something up in degrees that I couldn't do myself.
I think that is such a fabulous analogy for the editing process. Brilliant, like super visual. And yeah, I think that really holds true. Now, Megan, we are recording this episode and it will come out before the book has come out. I'm sure this feels like an interminable wait for you, but you are still in the lead up. I'm really interested in what people do in this period of time. And one of the things that you've already done, and that really sort of stands out about you as a debut author, is that you've cultivated a very active and sizable Instagram following.
Oh my God.
So tell me about your social media use in the past couple of years.
Okay. So I actually am really happy I'm getting to talk about this, because like anything, you know, I think when you look at someone's page, it's just such a single-sided kind of aspect to it, isn't it? And it's, I mean, it's really hard to show a well-rounded experience on social media. But so I was really, really fortunate that going into this, I had, God knows how, some reason, I got invited to Oxford years ago when I was writing my academic book, and I was talking about storytelling and narratives and a bit of creative writing. And for some reason after that conference, it was just when Instagram was starting, and so I think people were a bit less choosy in who they followed. So I think that people were just happy to follow me, and you know, I think people are selective now. So I think back then people were just like, yeah, follow you, what's your handle?
So what year is this?
So I have this beautiful little picture of my daughter, who must be 2 or 3, running on the grass in Oxford with this big sign next to her saying don't run on the grass. So this was so she's just turned 11, okay. So maybe 7, 8,
so the wild west ago. Of Instagram.
The wild west, maybe even 9 years ago, so 8 or 9 years ago. So yeah, so the academic book hadn't actually even come out then. I was still kind of working on it. So yeah, it was, I mean, none of us knew what we were doing. So people were happy to follow me because, you know, they just weren't as careful as with who they followed. and they just didn't unfollow me. So,
well, so I maybe that's why they started following, but they stuck around for a reason. So like, how, I mean, you have a marketing background. I wonder if that's influenced your approach, or were there certain types of things that you tried to post?
So I, and my agent will laugh if he ever listens to this, because I have and have had a tendency in my life, in high school and things like that. You know, I was the student leader and I did theatre sports and I made speeches, and that has always presented a certain version of myself. I come across as confident. I come across as extroverted. I come across as kind of knowing how to do all these things and liking to put myself out there and things like that. But the God honest truth, and I can't stress this enough, is that's not a complete picture of who I am. I'm very introverted, and that's kind of a learned skill on my behalf. And if anything, it's a survival thing, because, you know, if you're consumed in doing that, especially at public events, you don't have to socialize. And so people think I'm extroverted because I talk on a stage or I'm doing that. Really what it is, that's me being introverted, because I don't have to do small talk. I don't have to mingle. I don't have to do anything. All I have to do is write a speech, stand up, give it, and leave.
It's a bit like doing the dishes or something like that is another kind of out.
Like it's an out. Oh, yeah. I'm the best host, right? Not because I like to be the center of attention, but because it gives me a job.
Mm.
People can talk at the dinner table. I'm clearing plates. I don't want you to help. You know, because it gives me a job. So in some ways, social media does that for me in some ways, but I'll explain a bit more. So when I signed with HarperCollins and in the lead up, I didn't post personal things at all. It was all like other people's quotes and pretty pictures and, you know, scenery and things like that, and craft for kids in the holidays. And so I knew full well that there would come a point where I would have to, you know, post stuff. And I mean, have to is a strong word, right? But that, you know, I use Instagram like a website. That's kind of how I think of it. So I would need to kind of post things. And so I said to my agent, I'm going to start dipping my toe in the water, and I might need a bit of help. And I'm from marketing, and so I can, you know, if I'm doing this for the State Library, you know, we're not the State Library, like we opened the first Facebook page that they had, you know, so I can do this for an organization, and it's a lovely way to connect with people. But the idea of posting, though, it's so different. And the idea of posting a photo of myself, and I know that this doesn't seem real, because if you look at my feed now, it seems so, polished is the wrong word, but it seems probably a lot more confident than I honestly, God honestly am. So there was about 3 months when I would and this is embarrassing to admit, but I've promised myself that I will be completely to a degree honest and vulnerable about this. I would post photos and things and I would delete them.
That's so human. I feel like
I still do. And often I will be lying in bed and I'm going, oh my God, do people see that? And then now I've deleted it and they're going to know that I've posted it and then deleted it. So they're going to know that I think that's not, you know, that I'm either embarrassed or that that's not the right thing. And you know, I am deeply human in this regard. And I knew myself that it would take me a really long time to become comfortable and that I had to really be as brave as I could be, because when push came to shove, I didn't want to be dealing with these anxieties when I wanted to promote the book. You know, I'm 44 this year and this is my lifelong dream. And I want to give this book as much love and as much presence and enough connection as possible. And if I was dealing with these, really, they were deep-seated anxieties during that time, I didn't think I would be doing the book justice. So like I do with swimming pools, dipped my foot in, and I'm not a jump in the water person. And so I did that. And I think one of the greatest gifts that anyone on social media has, you know, given me is just not judging me as I was practicing and being really kind, because I think my greatest fear, you know, and I think this was one of my greatest fears in high school and growing up, is, you know, that people will think you're like, oh, look at me, you know, you just want attention and you know, you're doing this for attention. And really the God honest truth is that I'm happiest when I'm in a room by myself writing. You know, that's who I am in my heart. And so to be out there and posting things, it's taken me a good 12 months. And I still sometimes, you know, get scared and overwhelmed and very deeply self-conscious. But at the end of the day, I also really, really want to connect with people. And I'm trying to make some of the content funner and a bit more. I'm trying to learn new skills in it, you know, with reels. And I have an 11-year-old and she taught me how to do reels. And she's the one who started saying, Mum, you got to do some reels. And she kind of said, do this and do this. And I think to have my 11-year-old who, you know, and I shouldn't forget my 8-year-old too, because she is deeply talented in this area, probably more talented than I am. And, you know, they both encouraged me a little bit to step out of my comfort zone.
Vulnerability, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
I think sometimes I'm also more on the, far more on the introverted side of the spectrum. It's easy to hide behind shyness, isn't it?
Yeah.
I read an article where the writer was saying she asks herself, what would my fully actualized self do in this situation? And it's sort of a way of saying, yeah, am I just trying to get out of something that I really want?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And because I know that I am an overthinker, sometimes I hide behind jobs and tasks and doing things because I know that if I interact, then I'll be overthinking all the conversations that I have later, which I'm going to have to get over before I start book touring, because
the gift I have to talk to keeps people. Giving, isn't it?
I have, you know, you can't, your publisher can't send you somewhere and you can't clean the dishes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You're the show. So Megan, we're a couple of weeks out from the book coming out. We've talked about social media, but are there other activities or things that you're trying to do in the lead up to publication?
Oh, that is a really good question. So I think, and this is, I don't know whether this is actually answering your question, but I'm actually trying to write as much as I can on the next book. Mm. And I know that that's not related to this book, but in some ways it is, and I'll explain why. So because I know that I'm an overthinker and I know I'm going to be in hotels and things like that, I know that I'm going to, and I'll probably be by myself, you know, because my wonderful husband's going to be helping with the kids at home, right? To try and stop that overthinking a little bit. You know, if anyone out there ever comes up to me anywhere and has a conversation with me, I probably will overanalyze that conversation afterwards, worried that I've said the wrong thing to you. So I want to be deep enough in the next book so that, because I know enough now that if I don't direct my mind onto a book, sometimes I direct it badly at myself. And and that actually makes me a bit upset to think about, but yeah, I can really, I can beat myself up quite a lot. And so I know that if I'm, you know, on tour and in hotel rooms or, you know, whatever, that if I can't direct that somewhere, then it's not good for me. And so I want to be far enough into the next book so that I can work on it.
You
so
can that obsess I can... on that and stew yeah. on that and fill yeah. your brain with that.
Yeah, exactly. I can bring it with me. And it just allows me to push everything else, you know, that I don't want to do aside and go, right, how do I get my character out of that? Or why is my character doing that? And that that's what I'm trying to do in the next few weeks in the lead up so that I'm prepared.
I love that. Final question for this episode on the topic of things you are perhaps not planning to do, Goodreads. Yes?
Oh.
No? Like, what's the plan for Goodreads?
So after, you know, we got the book to early reader copy stage, my agent goes, you've got to set yourself up on Goodreads and Amazon and so forth. So, you know, I'm very good at doing what I'm told. So, you know, I'm doing what I'm told and I go on there. And so one of the things that I did, of course, was look up other books and other writers and what's on there for them, books I love, books I respect. And I've never been so traumatized in my life.
It's fun. Like, I remember signing up to Goodreads years and years and years ago when I didn't really write and flippantly handing out 2 stars, 3 stars. Now I shudder to think, but I guess you kind of have to put that in your mind that people are not, this is a reader's website.
Totally. I almost respect that because I'm a reader as well, right? Like, I read books as well, and I don't want to kind of be a bit self-important or self-indulgent and go, oh, you know, it should always be nice, because it shouldn't. You know, people are busy and people should be able to go somewhere where they get honest feedback about what they should read and so forth. So, like, I want to balance that by, you know, If I step back out of my very thin-skinned writer's emotions at the moment, I get it. You know, I'm a working mum, and if I'm looking to read a book, then yeah, great to go in a place and have a look. And you often don't delve into the nooks and crannies anyway. You're just getting a sense, right? And it's not even about how many 5 stars does it have. You're just looking at, you know, maybe other people who read similar books to you, what else are they reading and stuff, right? So I'm all for reading communities. Like, great, you know, if it gets people reading, fantastic. Because, you know, there are already so many barriers to reading in our life at the moment, then if something encourages, fantastic. So I would like to say, you know, we're talking about, you know, visualize what your, you know, best self or self-actualized version would do. My self-actualized version would have an account and be able to go dip in now and then and read the horrifyingly honest things that people say and put it into perspective and understand that, you know,
I reckon, not to contradict you, I reckon my fully actualized self doesn't care, doesn't even look like.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't
That's
even
me
look.
Speaking. That's me speaking.
I've kind of thought that maybe if I was self-actualized, I'd be able to go on there and read it and just wouldn't even affect me. Like a duck, like I'm a duck.
I know, I've tried that.
Whatever, man. But like
invariably, the only time you will go on Goodreads if you already feel bad is probably the reality.
Right, this is it. Like, it's 3 a.m.
Exactly.
It's 3 a.m. I've had a bad day parenting, already hating on myself. I raised my voice. I need another thing to hate on myself for, don't I? Yeah. No, you know what? I think it's going to be very hard to stay off it. I'm going to try really hard not to. To be honest, I think initially it's going to be so busy that,
yes,
you know, hopefully I'm not obsessing over that kind of stuff. I would love to say that I'm going to stay off it. I do know people who like block it.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
On their website,
yeah,
on their computer. And I'm just speaking kind of theoretically here because I'm not in the trenches of it yet. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. I don't have the type of personality where I have that much willpower. I mean, I'm pretty good, but, you know, it's kind of like, for me, it's like, okay, I'm not going to eat chocolate for 3 months. I will invariably eat a little bit of fruit and nut chocolate eventually.
Well, that also feels like something you say as you're consuming a large quantity of chocolate and it begins tomorrow. Like, right.
Yeah.
Megan Rogers, we will watch the Goodreads space. We will be coming back to you on this.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.